from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. KQED's own Belva Davis joins us in studio for Forum's Next Hour to discuss her recently published memoir, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. Belva, who's been in television for 43 years and hosts KQED TV's This Week in Northern California, was the first black woman TV anchor on the West Coast and has been the recipient of many top broadcasting awards. She also has quite a life story, which we'll talk about with her next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our morning forum program. Belva Jean Melton was born into hardscrabble poverty in Louisiana, the daughter of a 15-year-old laundress. We know her today as the award-winning iconic journalist and pioneering feminist Belva Davis, the first black woman news anchor on the West Coast and the recipient of Lifetime Achievement Awards from the National Association of Black Journalists and 8 local Emmys. She presently hosts the KQED Television Weekly broadcast This Week in Northern California. And now we have Belva's memoir, a rich and inspiring story of a woman who set out to fulfill her dreams and did. The recently published book, full of personal and professional tales and anecdotes and written with Vicki Haddock, is titled Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. Belva Davis joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. Good to see you.
Thank you, Michael, so very much.
Well, let's begin sort of at the beginning in some ways, because here you are, this legendary figure now, iconic figure. Everybody talks about Belva Davis, and I don't want to embarrass you, but we're old friends. You know, what class she has and what calm she has and all of that. And where you came from is something that most people simply don't know. A sad little girl, you describe yourself as.
Absolutely. Unfortunate. My mom was a young girl, really, when I was born. So as is the custom in the South, I was handed off to another relative, her older sister, and had a wonderful beginning. What I remember of it, anyway, is only joy. Unfortunately, she developed tuberculosis, and by the time I was a little over 3, she died. And I then was sort of a toss-up as to where I would go next.
Farmed out to different places.
That's true. Yeah. And so I moved around various relatives as I was growing up. Never quite knew where I was supposed to be. I mean, where was my home? I never could quite get a handle on that. I was in homes with relatives and houses with relatives. But their lives seemed to go on, and I seemed to always be standing on the sideline. And as well as I'm sure children feel when they lose a parent.
Yeah, but to live through Jim Crow and all this family turmoil and to just want to have a bed and a room of your own,
yes.
I mean, and also to endure, and you write about it courageously, the private hell, as you describe it, of molestation.
Yeah, I did. And that is the one chapter in the book that I felt, and I'll say this early on because the wonderful poet and writer Maya Angelou has always been a good friend and supporter, encouraging me to write this book. And when I got around to places where it was just too painful for me to want to even share with my children, I called her and she said to me, Belva, remember, tell the truth, just not too much of it. And so that became my mantra for this particular chapter of the book. I told the truth, but my children didn't need to hear and see the every detail of this.
They well, that's interesting because almost as a journalist, that's been a mantra for you too. That is, you've always stuck by the facts, always tried to be the full integrity, full throttle journalist. But at the same time, there were a couple stories involving your children that you felt you didn't need to tell.
No. It's been a difficult road now that I look back on it, Michael. I didn't think it was difficult when I was living it because instinctively decisions, you make decisions and you're not, you don't analyze every single one of them. And I must have developed some sort of defensive mechanism on behalf of my children and my family along the way while trying to pursue this life that served well to get me to this point anyway.
Well, there's this, for example, one of the most bizarre stories that you tell, and there's some great stories in here, when you were covering the craziness, really, of the Symbionese Liberation Army. And suddenly your daughter, you're told by police sources, is under threat because they thought you were Angela Davis's sister and you're going to get back even the score with Patty Hearst being taken by Sin Q.
Listen, this was one of the craziest spirits. It's almost comical when you think back on it. And I do remember the very first day that I learned about it, it wasn't comical. I was living in El Cerrito, and a member of the El Cerrito Police Department rang my doorbell before school one morning and asked to speak to me, and I asked my daughter to leave, and then I found out. And they told me, they didn't have great foundations for this, but there was a motorcycle gang at a bar where the motorcycle crews hung out anyway, and the rumor was that there was a plot to kidnap my daughter. They mistakenly thought I was Angela Davis's sister. She had a sister at that time living in Berkeley, but the only thing we had in common is that our last name was Davis.
And yours was Davis because of marriage.
Right.
And again, you write about the first marriage, which was troubling and difficult. You were saying before you got married, I don't want to get married. I don't want to get married. And I mean, now you're with this great husband who those of us who know admire and find a warm and wonderful guy. But you've had, again, these troubling years that you had to revisit.
Well, like many young people, I married too young. And I married for the very wrong reasons. I married because I couldn't I didn't have the money to go to San Francisco State, even though I had been accepted. All of my friends were students. They were involved in sorority life and in college life, and I was working for the Navy as a clerk to typist. There was not much to talk about there. So to put a little sunshine into this, my daily stories, which didn't have much, I decided to accept a proposal of marriage from my next-door neighbor, who also was young and immature. And it was a mistake, and I think I knew it from the beginning. And thank God I was forgiven for that mistake by having the rewards of the most wonderful man on earth as my husband.
Bill is certainly a gem. And so are you, by the way. he's a lucky guy, too. But you begin the book writing about the Cow Palace and the Republican presidential convention of 1964. And here you are beginning, I mean, you know, you for a while were working only where places that you could work, like Jed and Ebony, doing mm-hmm. things for black newspapers and black magazines and so forth, running a beauty contest, Miss Bronze contest. again, there's an amazing amount of stories here, a wealth of stories. But the bigotry, the naked bigotry of that convention in 64, and then you bring us to the 80s, and you bring us to Cummings, Georgia, where you're spit on. And it seems as if things really didn't change that much until you take stock of Barack Obama being elected president.
That's right. That's why it was so hard for me to believe that he'd really, truly been elected in a world that I saw both sides of, you know, the effort of black Americans to quote-unquote, free themselves, had been long and hard. And I didn't know whether this was Liberation Day or not. I didn't know whether people had grown that much that they could see, envision. And I, to this day, don't think people really understood the impact of having a man of color sitting in the White House. So it was hard.
Well, also, I think many of the young people who listen to this program can't imagine what it was like for you as a black woman, not only breaking into the world of media, but also living, for example, you write about moving to Oakland. You were part of that great migration that Isabel Wilkerson's written about, how racist Oakland was.
Oh, my God, yes.
Not only that, but, you know, you go to a bowling alley in Berkeley and they kick you out of the bowling alley. I mean, these kinds of things which people just
Can you imagine integrating a facility in Berkeley in the early 50s? That's exactly what I had to do. Not I didn't do it. Fortunately for me, one of my teachers did. But she taught me a lesson of a lifetime, the power of one woman to change big institutions and problems. And it was a simple thing. I could bowl at the Berkeley Bowl as long as I came with my teams from Berkeley High. But when I went back by myself to practice, I was told that I had to move on. I could not rent shoes. I could not get a bowling ball. And And I love my response. I mean, I did not know how creative I was at that age, but my response was, after I found out I couldn't do anything about it, was to draw chalk lines on my driveway, use my mother's Del Monte vegetable cans, and practice my backswing with cans on the concrete, until one day one of my teachers saw me doing it and said, "What are you doing?" And then, of course, the tears came, and I explained that I was not allowed to bowl at the bowling alley. And she went to the school principal, and they told the owner that either Belva bowls when she wants to, or all the Berkeley bowling activities will be pulled from this facility.
Yeah, an important lesson also in terms of all the boycotts that would later follow that you write about.
Yeah.
And again, Belva Davis with us in studio. Her new book is Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. I want to talk about that life in journalism, of course, but let's talk about something else that when you were younger and you were living through this difficulty and all this maelstrom of emotion, you actually talk about suicide and attempted suicide,
yeah,
and say that maybe divine providence made it so that it didn't happen. And you mentioned Howard Thurman as a very important mentor. In fact, there are mentors throughout this book, people who teach you lessons, like the teacher with the bowling alley. Where's faith now in your life?
Very strong, Michael. I mean, I think if you're a child and you're left to find your own quote-unquote salvation, you have to seek something that is nourishing in your mind that you think you can transform to the soul that you feel you have. My faith was not focused until I was an adult, but I grew up in a family that had me baptized as a very young child. I also realized that if you belong to a church, you belong to a group. You had a support mechanism and a nourishing community many times. So though I didn't understand the religious part of it, I did understand the relationship part of it. And later, through reading and finding a person that reflected what I wished and hoped the world still will be, one place for all, in the readings of Howard Thurman, it just opened a window and a door for me that I needed very badly.
Well, you opened a lot of windows and doors, certainly for black journalists and for women. In fact, a question put to me earlier this morning, we're going to hear, actually, go back with you to some of your work, showcasing some of it and having listeners maybe go through a strange kind of historical nostalgia. But somebody said to me this morning, what about black men and black women in media today? There seems to be an imbalance. You see more black women, particularly in television, than you do black men. I think that's true, isn't it?
It's historic.
Yeah.
From the beginning. I became very active with AFTRA, that's the American Federation of Television Radio Artists, our union. And from the beginning, we've been fighting for black male anchors, not just reporters. I mean, I meant
we're not just black sports guys.
Yes, not just sports guys. But we didn't even have them. But it's been a struggle always. And part of the thing, I was head of the EEO, the Equal Employment Opportunity Committee, for many years for AFTRA. And we were constantly fighting. And our last battle is just being won. We have not been able to make any inroads for Native Americans, but Asian American men were having as much trouble as black men actually had a break compared to the opportunities back then for Asian American men. So the battles are still continuing.
By the way, you talk about some of these battles with the union and many other battles and many other causes that you have been in the forefront of, but you didn't like the union at first, did you?
No. No, because unions used to be the gatekeeper of jobs. For instance, when my husband became the first black television news cameraman at a commercial station in the state of California. But so for him to get into the union, he needed the signature of three members that would say he's a great guy. Well, for an outside black man to find someone in a union and ask them to break with the brotherhood and sign your application to become a member was difficult. So after I got my job, the crusade began, and I wore the guys at Channel 5 down to the ground till we found three signatures for bills. So I thought of unions as a place where they kept black people out. It was only after I got involved in the work of it under the leadership of a very fine man named Bill Hillman that I understood the actual power.
Bill Hillman was over at KPIX.
Yes, yeah. And he was just one of the legendary national presidents of after the
Union. Boy, those of you who are interested in broadcasting history, you get a lot out of Melba's book on that. I mean, just local history in general. But, you know, there's that story you tell about David Sachs, for example, waiting a couple of hours wanting to look for a job at Channel 7, ABC, KGO television, and him saying, well, we don't hire Negresses, essentially, was what he told you.
What I've carried in my heart, because I met David and got to know him later, and he's a nice gentleman, I just think that what I experience is what so many minorities experience. Well-meaning person, not knowing at all that they're insulting you. I don't think he had a clue that what he said was would have been harmful or would have caused me to go to my car and cry. But it happened.
Well, wasn't there a grand dame who you don't mention by name who said, are you here to do the ironing, essentially?
Oh, my God, yes. And, you know, that story only has impact if you realize that I'm walking into a room with a white male who has a television camera on his shoulder. I'm carrying his tripod, which is the instrument he sets his camera on. And when this woman walks to me, the only thing she can see is my skin. And so that was the one time that I almost lost it. I think it's the one time I actually call the desk. I call Fred Zender and say, somebody else will have to do this story.
Yeah, Fred Zender, for many years, the director over at Channel 2 at KTVU.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's hear some of your work. In fact, let's go back in time here. First, a very tragic moment, but people have talked for years about the calm and the sort of tranquil nature of Dianne Feinstein under these circumstances. But Belva Davis also, of course, has been lauded for the same thing at a terrible moment in our local history.
Good evening. I'm Belva Davis. This is A Closer Look. Tonight, we expand our program to 1 hour to bring you the tragic story of the murders of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. Both were shot this morning, and tonight, ex-Supervisor Dan White is being held at the Hall of Justice on 2 counts of murder. The first official word came from Board of Supervisor President Dianne Feinstein, now the city's acting mayor.
President of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
Shock, fear, dismay, disbelief, all jumbled together. This is how one city supervisor described the mood of this city.
Well, there it is, that pandemonium, but also that voice of calm and reason. That's why people called you our Walter Cronkite, I guess, isn't it?
I tell you, sitting here listening to that, I still get chills thinking about that day. It was a day that you could not even describe the dismay. So for us to here at KQED with our nightly news program, without the facilities of the commercial stations, pull a program together that night that we hoped would help bring some comfort to the Bay Area was our mission, and that's what we really tried to do.
Let's hear another moment with Belva Davis actually grilling our now new governor, Jerry Brown, back in the press conference in 1974 when he officially announced his candidacy for the first time for governor of California.
There is a charge that, at least in regards to the newest Watergate issue, that your office is being used to promote your desire to be governor, to keep the name of the Secretary of State in the news. How do you answer those Republican charges?
Those are Republican charges. I'm glad you classified them. Well, I've enforced the disclosure laws against Democrats. The Proposition 8 campaign of last year, there were 2 Democratic senators involved.
Well, he sounds a lot younger, doesn't he?
Don't we
do you
both?
Sound younger to you, too?
Oh,
don't
boy,
you?
Do I sound younger.
And speaking of how you sound, there's a new Ms. Magazine, which has an excerpt from your book with Nancy Pelosi on the cover. They're giving a hard time to Newsweek and Time for not having her on the cover when she was Speaker of the House. And the picture of you that you weren't even aware of. How old are you in this picture, Flynn?
You know, my son was around then, so I was in my 30s, maybe just getting in, just getting into my 30s. Yeah.
And quite glamorous, if I may say so.
Well, I was in radio then, so I can't even say that it was due to having a good makeup artist. I guess that, indeed, I was a once upon a time, a young woman.
You did these beauty contests, too, and I mentioned, too. How did you get into that? I mean, first of all, I mean, people can't believe it, but there were no black women or women of color in beauty pageants.
Well, Michael, people used to laugh when I would say this was my civil rights effort. And it truly, and I know it sounds frivolous, but the Miss America pageant was closed to women of color. And so since black girls couldn't compete in Miss America, a friend of mine from Los Angeles decided there ought to be a pageant for black women. So he started it. I finished it here in Northern California. It was very successful. I think it was one of the added to the pressure to the Miss America pageant to open its doors, which it finally did. But it provided a screen test in Hollywood for these young women. Many of them have gone on to become very famous. Margaret Avery, one of ours, became an Academy Award nominee. I mean, we can name other names. The Fifth Dimensions came out of there. So it was a good effort. And the thing about it is we wanted these young women involved in civic life, too. So they had to do community service as well as look beautiful.
Yeah, but, you know, your role in terms of changing things vis-a-vis civil rights has been really quite preeminent and significant, particularly in this area. And even to the present, we talked on the air about the African Diaspora Museum, which you've been a major figure in terms of spearheading and on the board and so forth. So to say that your main civil rights action was in the beauty pageant, I think, is sort of understating it, if I may say so, in terms of your contributions. You've interviewed so many people through the years. I mean, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali. I mean, you had access because you were working at black radio station to many. Very funny story about James Brown, which I'll tease people with. Ella Fitzgerald, the names just go on and on. Former presidents, some of your encounters with Huey Newton, they're fascinating. One interview that you seemed to really recoil at was Lenny Bruce.
Yes. Lenny Bruce had an act that he played at, I think it was Basin Street West here in San Francisco. And the majority of it was the use of the N-word, where he simply sat on stage and repeated it on and on and on.
Because he said he was trying to demystify
it. That's what he said. When I asked him why, he said, well, he thought that if we put it in common use, if we said it enough, that it would lose its sting and lose its harm. And I was put to the test in this book because the first chapter has the N-word in it. But in this case, it was the only way to describe the degrading of the individual by using that word. His was as an entertainment vehicle, and I just recoiled at it. I walked out on his act, in fact.
So he just seemed to not like the man. I mean, that was the feeling I got from reading the book. You interviewed Castro.
Yes. Well, Castro interviews you. Let's be honest. He is a dynamic and overpowering personality, and it's very hard to direct the conversation where you want it to go. Number one, he uses the crutch of the interpreter. And so you really never know if he even – but of course, I found out later he does. He speaks perfect. Well, not perfect, but he certainly understands every word of English. But he chooses to use his native tongue, and it turned out to be good for him because it gives him a certain edge.
Talking with Belva Davis this hour, her memoir, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism with Vicki Haddock. Let me give you a telephone number, and those of you who are listening who would like to join us, please do. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny.
Today's meeting of the Associated Students Legislature here at San Francisco State College was a highly tensed one. The meeting room was filled to capacity for a vote as to whether the Associated Students should continue financial support of the All Negro Black Students Union Project of Black Communications. The project is headed by poet Leroy Jones.
It's my contention that a university has no real moral basis for existence unless it is there to refine experience in the communities at large, whether they be white communities or black communities.
That's Belva Davis talking with Leroy Jones, who changed his name, of course, to Imami Amira Baraka, and that was back in 1967 at what was then called San Francisco State College. Again, you were there. You're like Walt Whitman, you know, the one that was there and covered that strike. What a chaotic and crazy strike it was. Huh?
Michael, that tape tells you a lot about where we were. We were, as black people, we were between names, almost as we are now with African Americans and black. We had not decided, or some had not decided, whether they wanted to be called black. Others were still Negroes. So you see, I say the Negro Black Studies Program. So we were in transition. And
so was he. You were calling him Leroy Jones, and he didn't like it, I guess.
He did not like it. He had just taken that name. And frankly, I really didn't know how to pronounce it at that point. So it was easier. So we had a very tense, good professional relationship. And he regarded me as one of those who needed further education.
As he regarded most people of the Caucasian race as well, certainly. I think I told you about my interview with Leroy Jones. He said I thought I was in the CIA because I told him a story that happened at Wisconsin when I was there. These kinds of stories from that particular period of the Vietnam demonstrations, of People's Park, San Francisco State, the Black Panthers, the zebra killings, Marcus Foster, the People's Temple. I mean, all of them, again, were things that you covered that you just kept moving forward with, really. I mean, that's the feeling one gets in reading your memoir, one after the other, and seeing history being made.
I was fortunate that I was hungry to really cover the important stories. I didn't want to be categorized into the softer feature. I wasn't looking to be an investigative reporter, but I wanted to be a reporter of the history of our evolution, and we were definitely revolutionary during that period. And I was fortunate to be working in a place where it could happen, and fortunate enough to most times have a personal angle on why I needed to be there.
But you also wanted to make a difference as a reporter.
Yes.
And in terms of pioneering things, I mean, you brought breast cancer to public attention in ways that it really hadn't received the kind of attention it deserved, mm-hmm. thanks to some extent to Rhoda Goldman. Male breast cancer, thanks to Don Fisher. I mean, by that point, you had made kind of contacts of these rather significant and important people in San Francisco society, but at the same time wanted to tell stories that needed to be told.
Right. And I have to say that Don Fisher was a very brave person. When I did this story, and it was with Rhoda Goldman's help, and she called me, incidentally, because she was a one-woman army back then, trying to teach women more about self-examination and recovery after mastectomies. And she convinced Don that he should go on television. Well, about the same time, the offer, or his public offering, for what was to become the Gap Stores was about to happen. And a light bulb went on, and he thought, I can't let this story out. People will think that I'm ill and they will not, you know, invest money. And so he asked me if I would give my word that I wouldn't reveal his identity if he let the story go forward. And so maybe for 30 or 40 years, 30 years at least, I kept that secret until one day I called his wife, Doris, recently, and I said, may I use Don's name now? And she gave me permission to.
You also began to make the public more aware of racial profiling, and this was a story that involved your son, Stephen. Again, a story that you felt you didn't need to tell, particularly because it seemed like the Oakland police were getting back at you mm-hmm. through him.
Yeah. Well, I did a very hard-hitting, maybe one of the most hard-hitting stories that I've ever done, and it was about racial profiling. And what made it particularly bitter for the Oakland Police Department, we had evidence. I mean, it wasn't a story. It was members of the Oakland Police Force who were telling us that this was happening within their department. And so there was a great ruckus. It was front page news, the fight back, the push back from the department over the stories that we had aired on Channel 4. We had the police chief to come to the station, sit in the lobby till the station manager would speak with him to try to stop the story the day that it went on. We had police officers who came to Tommy's joint near KRON TV to harass our crew. We got tickets from cops that for little of nothing. So it was a pretty tense period in my life. And we continued with it until one day my son was pulled over and taken downtown. He was just starting to drive, maybe 17 or 18. And he was charged with making an illegal right-hand turn. And, of course, it was never formally filed, but he was held for a few hours. And I must say I got the message. And I've never shied away from whatever people wanted to throw my way. But I said, I cannot have my child become a pawn in this game.
And so, or be part of your story.
That's right. And so people never knew that this had happened. we decided.
Well, they know now.
They know now.
In fact, does your daughter know about she must know at this point the story about the, because you kept the kidnapping thing for a long time.
Yeah, we actually moved from the East Bay.
And she was angry at you.
I mean, God, she was angry. Yeah. She was just, I think she was seventh grade, just going into the seventh grade. And she could not imagine life without her friends that she'd grown up with, her grammar school friends. And here I was taking her away from all that was very important. And anybody with a teenage daughter will realize that.
But you were protecting her. You couldn't tell her
right.
that? And, or you didn't want to scare her?
No, I never told her. I didn't want her to live in fear. So we moved two blocks from the station, and she would come to the lobby of KPIX for a while, for a number of weeks, and sit in the lobby to do her homework. Because I also didn't trust having a housekeeper, or I just could. I was nervous.
Well, talk about not trusting having a housekeeper. There was a woman who worked for you, who you began to suspect, and probably even determined was maybe working for Jim Jones.
Some members of People's Temple on our program. I was working here at KQED, and after the whole tragic incidents in Guyana, and one of the interviewees said to me that the woman who had been my housekeeper was part of the security forces for People's Temple. And we found out in other ways. We saw her one day at an event where she was dressed in full uniform, and I was told then that the idea is that Jim Jones was forever looking for any press information that was negative about him. So her job was to collect the paper trash from our house to take it to the temple where they could go through it.
Talking with Belva Davis. Again, her book, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. And we're going to go to your responses. And by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in this conversation with Belva Davis. You can also send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this particular segment. Our first caller is Ati from El Granada. Good morning.
Oh, hi. I grew up in San Francisco in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And one thing I strongly remember is Belva interviewed my mom. She was the president of the PTA over at Sunnyside School near Glen Park. And my mom came home from that interview so impressed with Belva that to this day I always regard her as kind of the paragon of integrity in Bay Area news. And whenever I hear her voice, I hear the voice of the truth. That's it.
Okay. Well said, and thank you for that.
Thank you.
Let's talk for a moment about integrity, because it has been so important in your career, not only getting stories, but believing in fair and right and factual journalism. I mean, it's a cornerstone of faith almost, really, isn't it?
Listen, how could a black woman who had any respect for her own heritage not try to get at the truth? Because the truth of our history is enough, if people absorbed it, for the inequities to disappear tomorrow. I think a lot of the things that happen to minorities happen because we don't know the people that we are relegating to a lesser status. So it became important to me that if people were going to get to learn to respect or know one another, then you had to find out something other than the negative side of that culture.
More human side.
Yes, that's it.
But you're talking about the whole truth, really, as opposed to, let's say, the advice you got from Maya Angelou about writing a memoir.
Not in writing a story. She didn't mean that. She was talking about my personal history and
Well, there are some reporters who take license with the truth, as I'm sure you're well aware.
But, you know, she meant in terms of remembering that I had a family and remembering that I had children who I owed some protection to.
Here's Alfred, who writes, I wondered if Belva remembers sometime in the late 1970s when she did a lengthy and serious radio interview with Kathleen Cleaver, Eldridge Cleaver's wife, actually, there's mention of this in the memoir. At one point, Belva asked what Eldridge was up to. Somewhat embarrassed, she admitted that Eldridge had gone into the fashion business with a line of pants complete with codpieces called Cleavers. Just a week or so earlier, I happened to be in Los Angeles and accidentally ran across the small storefront in West L.A. where Eldridge was indeed selling his men's pants. It was a short-lived business, but because I had actually seen it with my own eyes, I knew Kathleen's story was true.
Kathleen Cleaver and I are still friends today. I've always respected her as being, in fact, she certainly her life has borne out what I said. She's a professor. She's well-respected. A brilliant woman. Who just happened to be caught up in a love affair that was not good for her, and I am thankful that she realized it. She's raised beautiful children, and it is no secret that Eldridge was not a favorite person of mine. But we developed a relationship, and I played some part in them returning to the Bay Area from exile, and mostly because of Kathleen.
You made friends with quite a few of the people that you got to know through your public life. I mean, Bill Cosby, Maya Angelou, Nancy Wilson. It's a rather impressive kind of Black Hall of Fame list.
Those are people that I met at the beginnings of their careers. And if you really want to know a celebrity, hope that you meet them at the beginning of their career. I mean, I think it was wonderful that I met Bill Cosby before he was married to Camille, when he was really almost a resident of the Bay Area here. And we've maintained not a close, palsy relationship, but a rare, very respectful relationship. And I count him as a friend.
Well, he writes the foreword to your book.
Yes, he does.
There's a sense in your book of some regrets, and one of them is, lack of education, formal education. Big regret.
I can't erase that one. I think it was because I came so close. I meant that I, got the grades and I was late in getting my application in because I won't even long story there. But I missed the opportunity to apply for scholarships. And when I realized I didn't have the money, it was $300 to get into San Francisco State. And I did poll members of my family looking for that $300. And it just was not forthcoming, and it didn't happen. And in fact, because
even with your uncle's Ezra's lawsuit that he won, $2,000 because he was hit by a side of beef, and actually they were going to tar and feather him, which is why I guess you came north.
Right. But Michael, he bought a house with that. That's how the house in Berkeley came about. Yeah, that could buy you a house on Ashby Avenue back then.
Unbelievable. That's not a Ripley's for most young people today. The other great regret, of course, is, and now I know you have a very loving and steadfast relationship with your children, but that you didn't feel that maybe you were more of a mother to them, I guess, because you didn't know how to be a mother.
I didn't know about the deeper needs that children have to have a more intimate, I guess is the word I would say, relationship with their mom. I did not have that growing up. And I thought that if I gave them the things, and I tell you, I was so crazy. My children, because I worked in news, they had a housekeeper, but I would come home late after the newscast, cook dinner, wake them up so that we could sit around the table together and have dinner. Because on TV and in films, that's how the proper families survive. So even though I had this barrier, it was silly. They laugh about it today.
It's like the Cleaver family, right?
Yes.
That's what Kevin said. Yeah. Here's Steve, who writes, please send my very best wishes to Belva Davis, a Bay Area news legend who I was fortunate enough to work for in the early 1980s at KQED. She sounds just wonderful on air, in great voice and fine spirits. I look forward to reading her book. You guys continue to do a terrific job at Forum. Thank you. Steve Talbot. And here's Carol, who writes two very different questions for Velva, one personal, another universal. What personal dreams would you yet like to see fulfilled? And what must we do to heal the black-white divide that persists in this country despite the election of President Barack Obama?
It's the same question. Learn to respect one another for who we are and respect the abilities of each individual. That's a big order. It's a big dream. That's why I call it a dream. But if there is a dream that I could magically snap my finger for, it would be to at least start the healing start the recognition that people can look different from you but can have the same needs and the same feelings and the same need for nurturing. Now, that's Pollyannish, I've been told all my life.
It's optimistic. I don't know if it's Pollyannish, but it certainly is. It's refreshingly optimistic. But when you write about 1987 in Cummings, Georgia, for example, and getting spit on and all that hatred, I mean, it almost reminds me of what Martin Luther King said about Cicero, you know, that you see that kind of bald and ugly, profane hatred, and you wonder, what can we do to get out of that?
That was my first time of actually facing hate. I felt I could feel it and see it. When I got close enough to these women, I was on a march, one of my first, one of the biggest one anyway, in Georgia. And I said to my photographer, Kenny Swartz, from was working at KRON, I said, well, Kenny, we got to get the other side. And he looked at me as though I was crazy. Now, you got to remember, they're Klans members, they're Confederate flags, they're burning, you know, black people in effigy at the front of the march. And I'm saying, yeah, we got to get the other side. So he said, let's go on. I said, no, there's some women standing over there. Let's go over and let's go talk to them. He said, Belva, let's go. You know, he's saying to me. So I go over with my microphone. I look at these women, and they look like normal people almost, except for the steel look in their eyes. And I said to this woman, I started to ask her a question, and she just got the biggest wad of spit she could get and just showered it right into my face. And Ken, acting swiftly, I was holding a mic, yanked the mic, gave me a handkerchief, and we started back walking with those singing We Shall Overcome.
Wait a moment. When you talked about the steel in her eyes, it reminded me, weren't you, at one point, I think you say that when you were doing those beauty contests, at Miss Bronze contest, you were called the steel fist inside the iron glove?
That was by my teenage girls, because I would say to their moms that I would keep them safe. And in order to keep them safe, quite often they lived with relatives or they lived with me. So we had camp at my house, sleeping bags, so that I could keep an eye on them. Because the last thing I wanted for any girl to have been taken advantage of.
Let me remind you, we're talking with Belva Davis, who is the author now of Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism, with Vicki Haddock. And she's appearing at the Commonwealth Club in conversation with Ray Taliaferro Thursday, February 10th at 6 p.m. And also appearing the 1st of February at Herbst Theater at 8 p.m. with Judy Woodruff as part of the City Arts and Lecture Series at, again, the Herbst Theater. You walk through the labyrinth every day still, huh?
Not every day. No, I can't say that. Whenever there is time. I mean, today, say, I could not do that. But, and I should have.
What does it do for you? What is it?
I think it's
this is a Grace Cathedral.
Yeah, this is making you be alone with yourself and with your thoughts. You have to find your way around those turns and curves. And so your eyes are on that, but your mind is free to fly. And I somehow find that liberating exercise. I think it's why people go to gyms and work out. You know, I know they want the benefit of the health part that comes from it. But a lot of times my husband says it's like running. You know, that's why he doesn't like to run with anybody. It gives him time with himself.
But it's also like what you've said about your life, that you just keep moving. You know, and that's what you've done your
right?
whole life. Just keep moving forward. And yet here you are looking back. I was just thinking about Satchel Paige. You said, keep moving forward, but never look back. But looking back, what's it provided a whole new dimension, whole new perspective to your life now at this juncture?
Well, let me just give Vicki Haddock all the praise that she's due, because, you know, it's hard after 40 years to remember the details of anything. And unless someone pushes you very hard, I'll take, for instance, the walk down the ramp at the Cow Palace. You know, I'd say, well, they were throwing trash at us. What kind of trash? Well, just trash. Well, what did it look like? Well, was it paper or was it solid? I mean, somebody who makes you go through that kind of make you go through that exercise. And if you're pushed, sometimes you will remember in greater detail.
Which is what a good reporter can do, too, of course, isn't it?
Of course.
And she's getting all this from you?
She is a good reporter, but more than that, a good editor. Because some of the things that you think are just absolutely must be in a book and are so precious, quite often are personal to you but may not be of interest to the wider audience. So I always say to my mantra now is either get a good editor if you're doing your memoir or get a good therapist to walk with you.
Well, there's a big message in your memoir, though, and that is stick to your dreams. fight for them and try to see them realize and believe in them.
And my children may be getting a little bored with that because mom is still...
Too much of a mantra?
Still out there, you know, at this point in life, taking on causes.
I was moved a number of times in reading your book and mentioned to you off air, particularly when I read about our mutual friend, Roland Post, who you worked with for many years and who to this day I think was probably the best political analyst we've seen, those of us who have seen many in our day. And you write very movingly about, you know, the extraordinary mind he had and deafness of mind and how, well, what Alzheimer's did.
Right. I mean, if I did not need Google because I worked with Roland Post on anything political. And he got calls from people all over when they were looking for facts. He had this really uncanny ability to remember details of campaigns that happened whatever year that they happened. And he was my seatmate and my friend and my buddy. And Roland said in an interview once that we were two who seemed to have nothing in common but had everything in common.
Oh, you're a great team.
I'm so privileged to have worked with him.
It was the first interview I did on radio, Roland Post, wearing his tennis togs, in fact, at the time. Well, we're talking with Velva Davis, and this is a time that you can show your support for this radio station, which, of course, we welcome and hope you will do. It's a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let's get another caller on for Velva Davis. And Mark, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Michael, for this wonderful show. And Velva, I'm just delighted to hear you and have been listening to you since I came to the Bay Area in 71. And I was wondering if you have any, if you could say a little more about your connection to Dr. Thurman. And how he may have influenced you and through your connection with him.
Well, Dr. Howard Thurman was the co-founder and pastor of the Church for the Fellowship of All People. It was the first interracial, interdenominational church in the country. And it still exists here right now on Larkin Street, San Francisco. But he was a universalist. He respected great religious leaders from varying viewpoints and tried to teach that through the many books that he wrote, I think 19 or 20 of them. He was the dean of chapel.
Did you see Bill Swing in that kind of?
Yes, they were. Yeah. And in fact, that's developed into something that Bill Swing has carried on. The Universalists. Sorry, I wish I could remember the name of the organization, but it continues on trying to bring about a blending and an understanding of various religious beliefs around the world.
Here's Jane, who says, I'm surprised to learn that Velva Davis did not graduate from college. When I was a senior at Mills in 73 and 74, she came to speak with us about establishing a career. Honestly, at that time, her skin color seemed less significant than the fact that she was a woman in the news business. She was inspiring to young women who were hoping for something more interesting in the way of a job than being a typist. Here's Kevin, who writes, I was an usher at the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco. Belva was in my section, and I couldn't help telling her how much I liked her on TV. She said, thanks, we try hard to do a good show, and I thought, no, it's you. You have a presence and voice that's so appealing. I couldn't help telling you how good come across to me as a viewer. And here's a question from Carol. It says, what do you think of Bill Cosby's exhortations to black people to lift themselves up?
Well, I think every group of people need to carry that responsibility on himself. We all need to have some responsibility for improving our conditions. I think that we're sensitive as black Americans because we know how hard it is to get out of the hole that we're in economically. So people bristle at Bill's comments. But it should be taken like all of the other advice that people are given who are striving for equality as one of the things that you need to put into your basket of goods to make the way forward.
Well, you and your husband, Bill, are now part of the Sonoma community. And that's been, in many ways, I'm hesitant to use the word, but kind of a godsend, hasn't it?
has been. We find ourselves, though, I have to admit, Michael, cannot tell, not tell it. We find ourselves, though, still with our lives centered here in the Bay Area, because this is, Bill was born in Oakland, and this is where we grew up. We love the serenity of going home to our little patch of weeds, and that's what people ask us, what do you grow, what do you do? We said weeds, because that's what's on the couple of acres that we have out there. So we're fortunate to have that wonderful, you know, piece of little plot of God's earth. But our heart and soul still remains here. And one day I said to Lynn Woolsey, well, you know, she's the congresswoman from out there. You know, I've not really changed my registration. The look on her face, if she could have, it would have hurt.
Talking again with Belva Davis, and she'll be at the Commonwealth Club talking, in fact, with Ray Taliaferro on Thursday, February 10th at 6 p.m. She'll also be February 1st, 8 p.m. with Judy Woodruff at Herbst Theater. What women news anchors or women in the media do you particularly find inspiring, even now as we talk? Well, Judy Woodruff, one of them?
Oh, of course she is. Yeah. And she is also one of the reasons why we have this book. She encouraged me some years back to stick to it. It was a story that needed to be told. So I am delighted that she accepted an invitation to come on a very quick turnaround to do this stage interview. She will be at the Herbst early in the day in the green room for a reception that the Lynx are hosting there. And so we hope people will come to the reception.
I think we're going to have her on forum, too.
Great. Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. She is a great gal.
So who do you admire in the media now?
Oh, my. Geez, there's so many people. I mean, everybody admires Gwen Ifill because she's, you know, she's solid as a rock. It's very difficult to sort out, you know, you admire some people for consistency. Kogi Robbins is somebody you admire for consistency. She's who she is. It's difficult. They're different kinds of women than the women that I grew up with who are the stars of the media today.
Well, you are one of them, certainly in the pantheon. Good to have you here, Belva. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for all the work you've done.
Thank you, Mike.
Stellar work. The book is Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. Belva Davis, the author. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.